from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the opening hour this morning, President Obama spoke at the Lake Tahoe Summit yesterday, highlighting his administration's commitment to fighting climate change. The speech came as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump staked their positions on a range of science-related issues. And as part of NPR's A Nation Engaged, a week-long conversation with NPR member stations looking at America's role in the world, we'll discuss the candidates' positions and the use and misuse of science in political discourse. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this morning's opening hour of the Forum program, we take up the role of science, not only in the upcoming presidential election, where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton stand as polar opposites on a number of scientific issues, but in the political realm in general. How are scientific positions of candidates playing out in campaigns and elections, and how important are they to voters? We're going to take all that and more up as we participate this hour in National Public Radio's A Nation Engaged, a week-long conversation, along with other NPR member stations, on what America's role is in the world, on the political stage, and beyond. And let me tell you who is joining us for this opening hour. We want to welcome first Marcia McNutt, who joins us this morning from Monterey. She's a geophysicist. She's also president of the National Academy of Sciences, formerly was editor-in-chief of the journal Science and director of the U.S. Geological Survey under President Obama. And welcome, Marcia McNutt.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning to you.
Glad to have you. And also welcome Kathleen Hall Jamison, who's joining us this morning from Philadelphia. She's professor of communication at Annenberg School for Communication and directs the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, the home of factcheck.org, SciCheck, which flags false scientific claims by politicians. And welcome, Kathleen Hall Jamison.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. And Sean Otto is also joining us this morning. He's in St. Paul, Minnesota, science advocate, author, and chair of sciencedebate.org. His latest book is The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. Welcome, Sean Otto.
Thanks, Michael. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. And let me begin, if I may, Marcia McNutt, with you. And let's just talk generally about why science and science discourse has been pretty much absent from certainly the debates after the Paris Accords were signed. One would have thought that climate change would have come up in those debates. But it's almost been somewhat of a tradition not to talk to any great extent, or to the extent that many feel or deem necessary, about scientific issues. Why is that, do you think?
You know, Michael, it's hard to understand why science is not informing the debates more than it is. There are so many good examples where candidates could be using science to bolster positions that they have to their advantage. For example, take the immigration issue. The National Academy has come out with a report recently that documents the degree to which recent waves of immigrants are incorporating themselves into U.S. society, which is actually a fascinating read. And it goes all the way back to earlier waves of immigrants, the Irish, the Italians, the Germans, the Norwegians, all the way up to today. And it shows that the most recent waves of immigrants are immigrating and incorporating themselves and actually assimilating into American culture and society at the same rate as the previous waves, and becoming as American as the rest of us and the rest of our ancestors did. So, you know, it just it's a surprise to me that information like this is not being used to bolster positions. I think it's perhaps because many of the candidates themselves are not scientists, and therefore they're not accustomed to using scientists' information, and they're not talking to scientists when they put together their talking points.
Which puts the onus to an even greater extent on the citizenry. And I'm glad you brought up immigration here, because that is indeed one of the number of questions, 20 questions, used to be a TV show by that name, that are put to candidates that Sean Otto is involved in. That's sciencedebate.org. And what do we have, 56 science organizations involved in this, and the presidential candidates have until September 6th, Sean?
That's right. Yes, 56 signed the letter to the candidates asking them to participate this, including, by the way, the National Academy of Sciences. But there are actually hundreds of organizations and universities that support the effort.
And there is certainly a whole array of questions here. Marsha McNutt mentioned immigration, but there's also biodiversity, nuclear power, opioids, ocean health, water. I mean, so many issues that you're asking essentially candidates to take a stand on or say what their position is. And you certainly got responses, rather detailed responses, from President Obama when he ran, from Governor Romney when he ran, from Senator McCain when he ran. How much of this information is disseminated to the public, and how much of it is available to the public or accessed by the public?
Well, that's part of the point, is that right now it's very difficult to find the candidates' positions on these to the extent that they've even articulated them. But in the past, as you mentioned, in 2008 and 2012, when the candidates provided answers to these questions, they made nearly a billion media impressions each time. So it was widely read and reported on in a way that hadn't been part of the political dialogue before. But our point is that this is really, really essential. Science and engineering now influence Americans' lives at least as profoundly as the domestic policy or the foreign policy or the faith and values issues that you often hear candidates talking about on the campaign trail. And we're actually projected to create as much new knowledge in the next 40 years as we have in the last 400 years. So we've simply got to find a robust way of incorporating this into our political dialogue.
So what do we do when it becomes part of the political dialogue, Kathleen Hall Jamison, and the facts just don't square? I know, for example, we were speaking about immigration, that contrary to what we heard from Marsha McNutt, Donald Trump has said that it's much more difficult for immigrants to assimilate, and they're taking more than they're contributing, which other research has pretty much proven not to be the case. And then we have, for example, Hillary Clinton saying that Trump called the Zika virus an insignificant issue, when he actually said it was a big problem. One of his unpaid supporters had said that the Zika virus was an insignificant problem. These things have to be checked, and yet, to some extent, like a lot of facts in a presidential debate, they're not.
Well, that's the role of journalism. And to the extent that journalists are talking to the scientists, are aware of the consensus scientific positions, and are ready and able quickly to respond, we increase the likelihood that misinformation that's consequential doesn't get through. I'm less concerned about an allegation about whether someone said that Zika was or was not a problem than I am with Michelle Bachmann, for example, in 2012, trying to discredit the HPV vaccine with a bogus anecdote, or Donald Trump suggesting the bogus association between autism and childhood vaccination. When you reach a very large audience, the debate in which Mr. Trump made that allegation reached 24 million people, it's very difficult for the best of journalism to ever catch up with that one moment in which a large part of the population, some of them vaccination hesitant, have just been misinformed.
Well, let's hear Donald Trump actually talking about vaccinations and autism at the Republican debate back in September 2015.
I am totally in favor of vaccines, but I want smaller doses over a longer period of time. Because you take a baby in, and I've seen it, and I've seen it, and I had my children taken care of over a long period of time, over a 2 or 3 year period of time, same exact amount. But you take this little beautiful baby and you pump, I mean, it looks just like it's meant for a horse, not for a child. And we've had so many instances, people that work for me just the other day, 2 years old, 2.5 years old, a child, a beautiful child, went to have the vaccine and came back, and a week later got a tremendous fever, got very, very sick, now is autistic.
Now, what is political discourse and journalism supposed to do about a statement of that sort, Kathleen Hall Jamison?
Well, I can tell you what we and the other fact-checking organizations did. We posted within 2 hours the statements that from the most reputable scientists in the world who failed to replicate the bogus Wakefield finding. And we also tried to do it in a fashion that would suggest that there really wasn't any controversy here. There is no evidence of an association. We at the same time had the benefit that the other fact checkers did as well. We had 1.2 million hits on that story by 8 o'clock the next morning. Here's the problem. 24 million people heard it, and the 1.2 to 4 who actually picked us up very quickly probably weren't the ones most susceptible to believing it when they heard it. So the best of journalism isn't a corrective if we can't catch and contextualize in real time. I wish the debate moderators had stopped the debate at that point, known their science, and said, that's been thoroughly discredited, Mr. Trump.
Part of the problem, though, let me go back to you, Marcia McNutt, is not only are the candidates perhaps short on scientific enlightenment or don't necessarily have the kind of awareness of scientific issues that they ought to have or should have or might have, but that's true in many cases of the journalists as well.
I think you're right there, but if I recall that Trump debate, I believe there was a candidate on the stage who had an MD who could and should have challenged.
You mean Dr. Carson, Ben Carson?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Who could and should have, with the Hippocratic Oath, have challenged that statement and said, no, Mr. Trump, that is not a correct statement. And the harm that will be done to thousands, if not millions, of babies by making statements like that that are scientifically known to be wrong is too horrible to let a statement like that go unchallenged.
And yet those statements do go unchallenged. Donald Trump, for example, now the Republican nominee, said that despite what all overwhelming number of scientists have put forward, that climate change is a hoax. In fact, he said maybe a hoax invented by the Chinese.
Let me step in for just a moment by saying that although he has repeatedly talked about it in terms of hoax, he did say that his tweet about it being perpetuated by the Chinese or created by the Chinese was a joke.
Yeah, well, sometimes what he says is a joke or sarcastic is difficult when he pivots around at a different point. But I want to get into some deeper issues here if we can, because I think we're not only talking about the responsibility of rigorous journalism, but also how much the body politic and citizens deserve this kind of discourse. And let me go back to Sean Otto on this. And Sean Otto has a book called The War on Science, and I'm going to take the liberty, if I may, of reading just a short passage from your book, Sean Otto, and getting you to comment on it, because you sort of take on both sides in this. You say, politically, the war on science is coming from both left and right, but the anti-science of those on the right, a coalition of fundamentalist churches and corporations largely in the resource extraction, petrochemical and agrochemical industries, has far more dangerous public policy implications because it's about forestalling policy based on evidence to protect destructive business models. As well, the right generally has far more money with which to spend on disinformation and to attack science on a host of issues. But then you go on to say those on the political left often unwittingly abet the right's anti-science efforts by arguing that truth is relative, harboring suspicions about hidden dangers to health and the environment that are not supported by evidence, and selectively rejecting science that doesn't affirm their health food and back to Eden value system. While they are right that there are serious environmental and health threats afoot from poorly regulated industries, they undermine their credibility when they extend these suspicions to scientifically unsupported ideas like vaccines causing autism, cell phones causing brain cancer, or genetically modified crops being unsafe to eat. And some of those points we have a lot of listeners who feel very strongly on, to put it mildly. So what you're saying is there's a kind of war on science that is affected and that is exacerbated by both sides of the political spectrum, I believe.
There is, although, as I say in the book, the danger of avoiding regulations that are supported by the evidence or forestalling legislation that would deal with something like climate change, for instance, is far greater than the danger of saying I'm not going to eat GMO food or that I'm going to advocate for labeling because I'm concerned about it. The avoidance principle generally has less of a negative impact than full well denial of known information.
Well, what if that information,
Let me just say, too, I just wanted to bounce back on one point. There's something that Kathleen Hall Jamieson spent a lot of time working on, is countering a journalistic precept of balance. And a lot of journalism has moved away from the idea that there is such a thing as objectivity, which I think is part of the problem here. It's important for a reporter to acknowledge that they are not objective in their own reporting. But what we see, to your point about debate moderators, is generally an attitude, and I've encountered this over and over and over in speaking with political journalists, that they think that they are neutral arbiters and it's not their job to report on which side is speaking with the evidence and which side is just voicing an opinion.
I confess to you, this has been an ongoing problem for many of us in national public radio stations because we see the evidence and we're convinced by it, and yet we feel the compulsion and the necessity, and our listeners want to hear what at least passes for both sides, even when the evidence can be overwhelming. But I'm also interested, and let me go back to you, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, on this about, for example, Politico submitted I talked about Trump submitting a plan on a golf course to build a wall to prevent further erosion from climate change. And this is someone who says he doesn't believe in climate change. Or, for example, in North Dakota, he talked to he gave a big petroleum speech, and he talked about the importance of how foreign bureaucracies are having control over much of the energy use in the United States, which is simply not true as a result of what he feels came out of Paris climate talks. So when you take things like that and you say, well, Mr. Trump, what did you mean, and so forth, but don't challenge him on just the fabrication that's involved in that, I don't think you're doing your responsibility.
One of the things I think is difficult for journalists to grapple with and the public to understand is that sometimes when you hear people ostensibly attack the science, for example, attacking the consensus about the existence of anthropogenic climate change, what they actually are attacking is the regulatory structures and the taxing proposals that are in place to try to deal with the problem. And if you listen carefully, and you can hear that that is the focus of their concern. We haven't figured out, however, how to pin them down to say, are you actually saying that if we could find a way to do this that did not cause regulatory problems for you or tax problems for you, you would grant that there is a problem that we need to address? And the fact that we don't know how to phrase those questions is a journalistic failure, because it's the journalists who speak to those politicians for us. If you look carefully at what Mr. Trump has said, what you hear is are statements that say global warming is really taxation. Well, what is that a shorthand for saying? He objects to the cap and trade structure, for example, as a solution. If you really pressed on that, where would he be on the science? Is he familiar with the science? We don't know because the journalists haven't asked.
Well, there's also another. I'm sorry, Marcia McDowell, you want in here? Go ahead.
I couldn't agree with Kathleen more on that, and I think it extends to the American people, too. Many times when they say, I don't believe in anthropogenic climate change, what they're really saying is, I don't want to make what I believe are the personal sacrifices I think you are asking me to make in order to admit that I am responsible for it. Whereas if you rephrase it to say, if we could come up with ways that you could still have a personal car and you could still do the activities that you want to do, but still would not be polluting with CO2, would you look at this evidence and say that, yes, humans are responsible for climate change? Most of them would say, yes, I think the evidence is obvious.
Marcia McNutt, again, is president of the National Academy of Sciences. Sean Otto is science advocate and author and chair of ScienceDebate.org and author of The War on Science. There's another side of this I'd like to get your light on, Sean Otto, and that is, for example, when Donald Trump talks about space, he'll say, and space exploration, space is terrific, but we've got to be more concerned about potholes. In other words, we don't have enough money, and therefore we should talk about things that are more important than space flight. He'll say the same thing about climate change. You know, our president's worried about global warming when the military is depleted or when we have to worry about ISIS. So there's a kind of prioritizing that comes across that allows not to address really scientific questions.
Right. And that's kind of a political game in a way, too, because a lot of these issues are interrelated, as the president will know, whoever becomes president at this point. For instance, the rise of ISIS has been shown through a couple of scientific papers to be fairly closely tied to a 5-year drought that happened in Syria that was really linked to climate change.
And I think you're forgetting the fact that Hillary Clinton was responsible for ISIS, according to Donald Trump.
Yeah. That's right.
That there actually is no drought in California, according to one of these candidates.
Right. And, you know, while the politicians are talking about this, the Department of Defense in their quadrennial defense update looks at all of these issues and projects more problems with migration, more political stress like we're seeing in the European Union because of that, driven by climate change and driven by desertification, drought, or sea level rise. So all of these science issues have real-world geopolitical impacts on Americans' lives. And it's very important for candidates for president, and particularly for journalists in this day and age when science is having such profound impacts, to get their minds around grounding things in the evidence and challenging candidates when they don't do that.
We're coming up shortly on a break, but Kathleen Hall Jamison, I want to go back to you because you've written a great deal about the speaking styles and the habits of mind and temperament and really character about both of the main candidates for the presidency. And how revelatory towards science is the fact, for example, that you make this binary between Hillary Clinton being cautious and Donald Trump being impulsive?
It's important to ask, what do we know about human psychology? And there's a whole lot of science behind human psychology. And what's the likelihood that dispositions developed across long periods of time, deeply ingrained, habitual behaviors are going to change once someone enters office? We often talk about science as if psychology and sociology isn't really part of the mix. It is. And it's the understanding from those branches of science that tell us that you've pretty much locked in your dispositions to behave in certain ways by the time you're in the late 60s or when you're 70. And as a result, if impulsivity is one of your characteristics, that probably isn't one that's going to change. Nor, if you're wary by nature, is that going to change in office. How does that translate into governance? Well, it depends on what you're focusing on. Impulsivity, you worry about the nuclear codes. Wariness, you worry about acting quickly when you need to.
Well, we are focusing, if you just joined us, on science and its role in the political campaign, not only for the presidency, but political discourse in general and campaigns. And I think everyone on the panel and your host are in agreement that there's not enough of a focus on it and what to do about that, and what to do particularly about the kind of, I suppose you could call science illiteracy or semi-literacy that afflicts so many citizens and afflicts many candidates as well. Let me invite you to join this conversation, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We want to hear from you, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. That number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so be part of the program by calling in at 866-733-6786. Other ways, of course, you can communicate with us. Let us know what's on your mind in this discourse that we're talking about, questions or comments you might have. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Please feel free to join us with Marcia McNutt from the National Academy of Sciences, Sean Otto from ScienceDebate.org, and Kathleen Hall Jamison from the Annenberg School for Communication. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama yesterday addressed the annual Lake Tahoe Summit, highlighting his administration's commitment to fighting climate change and protecting natural resources. And the speech came as presidential nominees Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump staked their positions on a range of science-related issues, including climate change and energy policy, science education, nuclear power, and vaccines. As part of NPR's A Nation Engaged conversation, we're discussing the candidates' positions and the use and misuse of science in political discourse and public policy. Let me actually have you, our listeners, hear a clip here before I reintroduce the guest we have with us of Hillary Clinton from her acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, where she told the crowd her stance on climate change and clean energy.
I believe in science. (Laughter) I believe climate change is real and that we can save our planet while creating millions of good-paying clean energy jobs.
Well, I've got a number of strong comments that I want to read here, but first let me remind you that we are talking with Kathleen Hall Jamison, professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication and the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, home of FactCheck.org SciCheck, which flags false scientific claims by politicians. And Sean Otto with us from St. Paul, Minnesota, science advocate, author and chair of ScienceDebate.org, author of The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. And Marcia McNutt, who is with us here on the West Coast in Monterey, geophysicist, president of the National Academy of Sciences, and formerly editor-in-chief of the journal Science and director of the U.S. Geological Survey under President Obama. And I just want to, before I read some comments and go to our callers, Marcia McNutt, get you on record about, I know there was a lot of work done when you were with Science Magazine about, well, being committed to peer review and all of that. And there was a whole flap about something that was published that did not have correct data and so forth. So I'd like to just get you on record about how, for example, on every level, we can assure that things are being checked and things are, like Kathleen Hall Jamison said, that the public is being aware of what's being checked and needs to be checked.
Right. Well, peer review is, of course, not perfect, but it is the best system that we have yet devised for determining whether the authors and those who are making statements have done their homework and that scientific information has been properly vetted. So the institution of peer review is so foundational to the scientific process for ensuring that whatever makes it into the scientific document and for what readers are looking at has had the sort of scientific seal of approval. And that is why scientists look for peer review as the certification for what they believe. Now, that, as I say, it's not imperfect. And so generally, all of us in the scientific enterprise are looking to improve things through openness and transparency, and we generally look to also see that scientists have posted their data, that they have been open and transparent about their methods, and that ultimately that scientists' experiments and their approaches have been reproduced by others so that it is more than one group that can verify the findings.
Let me bring a caller on here who has a question for you, Marcia McNutt. It's Daniel. Daniel, join us.
Hi, how's it going? My question was, should the National Academy of Science hold their own debate with both candidates?
Marcia McNutt?
I'm sorry, I missed the last part.
I just want to know if the National Academy of Science, should they hold a debate for both candidates, sponsor a debate?
Well, you know, the National Academy, I believe if the two major candidates came forward and asked the Academy to host a science debate, we would be willing to do that. And we would be happy to do that on the behalf of the American public.
All right, Daniel.
And we would do that with Science Debate and with Sean.
Daniel, you got your answer, and I thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on here. That's Larry. You're on. Morning.
Yes, good morning. A couple of years ago, Michael, you had two Nobel laureates on your program, and they were complaining about the lack of money for basic research. I called in and I said, well, why don't you guys get out and demonstrate? They drive to work in their BMWs and their Mercedes. They complain that their research assistants are going to other countries because money is available in other countries for basic research. They other people in companies and in research areas and universities, they don't complain about all of the money that their research provides to Big Pharma, and Big Pharma doesn't provide money for them. I think scientists are just a bunch of wimps. They've got to demonstrate. They've got to get out in the streets. They've got to organize across the country, research organizations and universities, and complain about this and get it in the public. We're looking for them to lead us.
Well, what about that activism, Larry? Let me cut to the chase here, and thank you for the call. Kathleen Hall Jamison, science populism among researchers, leading researchers, getting out in the streets and waving the banners?
I'd prefer to find a way to make the case for basic research in a way that appealed to a mass audience rather than local demonstrations. One of the problems with making the case for basic research is that this kind of important foundational knowledge often doesn't have practical application immediately. It has it in the long term, and nonetheless benefits our economy, benefits our national defense, benefits the public well-being, and it's difficult to make the argument for something where people don't see immediate tangible results when on the table are other public goods that have more tangible results. But because it is a public good, the generation of this knowledge doesn't have an immediate translation into a benefit for an industry. That this needs to be federally funded. And people who question whether basic research is desirable need to ask themselves, how comfortable would their world be if we didn't have such things as the internet and GPS? And where would our economy be had we not had the computer chips that make much of the way in which our worlds work? All of that occurred because of basic research. But we haven't done a good job explaining how those unanticipated byproducts down the road, which do occur pretty reliably, need the investment now in basic knowledge.
Well, there has been at least some talk about the need for increased research, mostly coming from the Clinton camp. They've been talking about ramping up $2 billion on Alzheimer's research, which is now at $600 million, and need more money for the NIH and National Science Foundation. A lot of these things have not come up with the Trump campaign. I just state that as a fact. If you go, in fact, to the Trump website, you will see no positions on many of these issues. But perhaps I'll get back to you, Sean Otto, and the 20 questions that you've put out to candidates. But I want to get back to you on something else before I bring more callers and listeners into this, Sean Otto. And that is, we think of ourselves as a democracy and we want to believe in an informed citizenry. But there's still nearly half of a population, according to a recent Gallup poll, that don't accept evolution.
Yes, that's true. But there's also a lot of science that shows that people have two different frames that they hold on this, and that they are not necessarily mutually exclusive, that people can selectively believe in evolution or they can also believe in creationism or intelligent design at the same time. And I think that there are some fairly well-known scientists as well who hold somewhat similar views. So it's a complex thing, the way that we think as people, and a lot of it is motivated by emotion. This is a challenge. It's been a challenge from the beginning of the scientific revolution. Francis Bacon warned us about this idea of confirmation bias, that what a man had rather were true, he more readily believes. And I think that that's as true today as it was then.
I do want to go to more of your calls. Let me go first to some listener comments. A listener writes, our elected officials have a duty to legislate from solid evidence, not from fear. They have a duty to protect their constituents and keep them safe, especially children. Fear does not give people a right to make the world a more dangerous place for the rest of us. We actually asked our listeners on social media what scientific issue deserves the most attention from the next president, and Kate says, and many others say, climate change. But here's Clem, who says, related to climate change is renewable energy. The next president needs to upgrade the power grid to better handle decentralized energy production, distribution, and storage. Walt says, science funding and funding for science education is indeed the most important issue for the next president. And Kenny writes, what about candidates' positions on NASA and the role of NASA in political discourse generally? What about it, Sean Otto? It hasn't really come back into the center of discourse here to any degree, really.
It hasn't. Well, on clean energy, Trump thinks that solar is an expensive way of making tree huggers feel good about themselves, is what he said. Clinton does contrast with that. She wants to deploy 500 million solar panels and make every home renewable by 2026, she says, within 10 years. So I think that there are some clear differences on some of these positions to the extent that they're known. But the candidates really have not been pushed by journalists on these questions yet. This is why initiatives like the Science Debate Initiative are so important.
And we will bring on more of your calls. We'll go next to Kelly. Kelly, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm just curious to find out what the panel's thoughts are on the fact that so many of the scientific journals that are published with the actual data and final conclusions are not free to open public access and are for access by pay only, which, of course, limits the potential for the general public to have the final conclusions not drawn by someone outside of the scientific community.
Now, let me go to you on that, Marcia McNutt, if I may.
Yes, well, different journals have, of course, different models for how they can fund their operations. There are many that are open access, and so the author pays for them to be published. And so the model is that the all of them are ultimately paid for by the government. Some, the money flows through the author, and they're free from the get-go. The others are paid for through subscriptions to institutions. Even those that are not free from the beginning are usually available through within 6 months to a year, and so there's a delay in getting them. So I agree that for those who are not affiliated with some research institution, those that you cannot get immediately, there is some delay, which is not ideal, and that's a problem. But with so many authors now going to the open access model, I think that's changing, and some people are predicting that within a number of years that many, if not most, journals will be immediately available. So there's that to look forward to.
Thank you for that. Marcia McNutt, again, is president of the National Academy of Sciences and former editor-in-chief of the journal Science. I'll thank that caller and move on to another caller. Catherine, we thank you for waiting. Join us, please.
Thank you for taking my call. First, I just would like to say how relieved I am to hear a discussion having to do with the claims being made by certain candidates. What I have noticed and what has been endlessly frustrating is how journalism or journalists, PBS included, seem to repeat back everything that Trump has to say and swallow it whole. I'm thinking that why couldn't the format of these reports at least be adjusted so that if one candidate makes a claim, science claim, that there be a counter report? Well, you know, if Trump says, well, this vaccinations cause childhood illnesses like autism, why can't that be balanced with a counter report that says, however, according to blah, blah, blah science, this theory has been disproven, so that the general information that we get by way of news is at least balanced in its reportage. Right now, all I hear on every news station, including PBS, is regurgitation of everything that Trump has to say without any commentary except for the brief comment period allotted to two journalists in the middle of the program.
Right, Catherine, thank you for that call. I'm sorry, I didn't need to move on, but I appreciate hearing from you and your suggestion along those lines. In fact, another listener, kind of dovetailing with Catherine's comment, writes, like in a lot of other areas, no one corrected Mr. Trump's statements on vaccination during the Republican debate because they didn't want to alienate those among his followers who eat that stuff up with a large spoon. But let me hear from a listener who is maybe on the other side when it comes to vaccines. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I would just like to
just putting it out there, it feels to me, I mean, I really appreciate this discussion, and it's much needed. I feel like the vaccination issue is not exactly the same as those who reject evolution. I know there are just such strong feelings on both sides of this issue, but you could make the argument that the position in, you know, the denial of climate change, the creationism, those positions, there's an implicit idea that comes from a certain kind of ignorance. And I can only speak for myself as a mother, as a teacher, that my position, which is not a black and white position on vaccine safety, it is a tortured position, and it does not come from ignorance. So it feels dismissive and even disrespectful to those of us who have spent years actively researching and studying these issues. And I even hesitate to put myself out there because there is such active hostility everywhere you look. And unfortunately, Mr. Trump, I do not want him to be, you know, he's not on my side of any issue. It's just,
Chris, I understand. I mean, you're really being very thoughtful in this, and I want to give attention to what I think you're suggesting here. And I'd like to hear from Sean Otto, because is there a danger of conflating, you know, climate change, evolution, GMOs with anti-vaccine people who, like Chris, you know, clearly give this a good deal of rumination?
Well, you have to remember that a lot of climate change deniers also give their position a good deal of rumination. The problem is when we start to selectively accept information that feels right or that confirms our suspicions or our fears, whether they be of hidden dangers to health and the environment or whether they be of overreach by government regulators or by people wanting to instill global socialism, as the many climate deniers seem to feel. What we have to remember, and this is where it comes back to journalism in a way too, is that we have to base our public policy positions and our personal positions to the extent that we can on what the evidence, the overwhelming body of evidence, suggests. Science is really pawing around in the dark. Some things we don't really know for certain. But when an overwhelming amount of the known information or data on a subject is pointing in one direction, it's really the responsible thing to do to set our suspicions aside and to say, I got to go with the evidence.
How much of this has to do, in your judgment, Sean Otto, with a distrust of science or scientists for that matter? I mean, you know, not only the old idea of the mad scientist, but that scientists aren't necessarily right all the time. And, you know, they've led to, for example, the splitting of the atom, which has put us in serious danger, one could argue. I mean, all of those things play in here, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. Science is, I always say, science is never partisan, but it's always political, because it either confirms or disrupts someone's vested interests or cherished worldview. And those conversations, plus the moral parsing, moral and ethical parsing of new knowledge and incorporating its implications into our public policymaking process, that's also a political discussion. So the two are intricately intertwined, and we have to be sensitive to the views of others. But ultimately, when we're promulgating public policy for everyone, we have to go with what the evidence suggests.
There's also another wrinkle in this, and let me go to you on this, Kathleen Hall Jamieson. We had a caller on who had to go off who wanted to talk about Jill Stein, the Green candidate, and her lack of support for solar, even as a Green Party candidate. And she's also been criticized for going over the top on sea level rise numbers that just didn't equate. And I bring that up because it's not only maybe that science is ignored, but third-party candidates are ignored. And some of them would like to be in the debate. Gary Johnson, for example, the Libertarian candidate is up at about 9%. If he can raise that to 15, he may actually get on the stage and in the debate. But he's also said things that are really off kilter with accuracy. He talked about Colorado and marijuana and said the effect of marijuana on traffic deaths is minimal and almost insignificant. So one wonders, you know, how that can get into the discourse as well, because those candidates are ignored, whether they have good points or bad points.
Yeah, we've got our political process structured to try to drive the third-party voices out, and it's unfortunate because worthwhile ideas get marginalized as a result. And one of the problems for journalism is in a year in which there's a great deal of fact-checking that has to be done because we have very many consequential issues at place and a lot of lack of facticity, it's difficult to find the time and the space to make sure that one does justice to the third-party candidates. So they are closed out of the discourse. They don't get the kind of access they deserve throughout the process. And when they do get some access, the journalistic enterprise doesn't have the time to treat them seriously by taking them, making them responsible for what it is they say. I wish we had more resources. I wish we had more space. I wish we had more venues of access to let those ideas percolate into the system.
And I'm going to go to Pennsylvania next and welcome another caller. Rhett, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, hi, Michael. I'm glad to get on with you. My comment has to do with the funding, government funding of research and development, which I can fully support. But I do have a little problem with once those developments have been made and things are learned, I'm not so sure that the benefits who were funded by the taxpayers really are equitably dispersed and returned to the taxpayers. For example, I understand that Apple, I think that the government had a lot to do with the early stages of development in the computer world, of which the foundation upon which has built Apple. Well, Apple recently was charged with needing to repay taxes that it wiggled out of over in Ireland. They paid $500 on every $1 million of earnings, of profits, over in England, and they do that through loopholes. So I wonder about is there a mechanism that is in place that when and if these developments come to fruition, that there is a strong reimbursement with if it's got to be...
Well, right. Excuse me. You're not talking about accountability, but you're talking about some way to codify or to actually ensure that government investment ought to have appropriate channels and all the rest of that. It's a big question. Marcia McNutt, can we hear you on this?
Well, okay. So the way that the university research is supposed to translate into jobs, industry, and technical advantage. And I know for a fact, because I've had two daughters who have worked for Apple, that they actually have gone on to great paying jobs from Apple, and they've been very gainfully employed as a result of the technology that was developed in America through university research. And there's huge buildings going up down the street from where my daughters live that will employ thousands of people in Silicon Valley. And they will buy American products and live in homes and raise their children and send them to school and support the California economy, all because of investments in technology that was supported by the American government. And that's all because of the Bayh-Dole Act. And I think that's the way it's supposed to work.
Well, we're getting close to the end of this hour, a very informed and enlightening hour, although I'm looking at listener's comment. It says, this dialogue seems naive given political realities. How do you make evidence-based reasoning emotionally appealing? A very important and fundamental question, I think. But Kathleen Hall-Jamison, let's conclude with your response to this remark that a listener puts forward here. It says, I'm a physics PhD and a millennial, working as a nuclear physicist, I'm disgusted by the rampant rejection of facts and knowledge and the embrace of anti-intellectualism this election cycle. I see parallels between Trump's candidacy and the Brexit vote, most notably the public castigation of the elite intellectuals. How can a young scientist like myself have a bigger megaphone than Donald Trump? Can your panel, any of them, recommend an effective way to counter this rhetoric, his rhetoric? Or Kathleen Jameson, I go to you. You're the professor of communication. Some thoughts.
Voters influence each other. Communities are the locus of discussion on politically consequential ideas. The discussions we're having with our families, our friends, in our workplaces, at our communal places of association help shape decisions about how people are going to vote, and importantly also about how people are going to come to understand science. Having scientists in those discussions, actively in the community at every level, will increase the likelihood that we have good decisions that are evidence-driven and reason-based.
We will leave it there, and I want to thank Kathleen Hall Jameson, who joins us from Philadelphia, joined us from Philadelphia this hour, professor of communication with the Annenberg School of Communication and director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at University of Pennsylvania, home of factcheck.org's SciCheck, which flags false scientific claims by politicians. Thanks also to Marcia McNutt, geophysicist and president of the National Academy of Sciences, formerly editor-in-chief of the journal Science and director of the U.S. Geological Survey under President Obama. And thanks also to Sean Otto, science advocate, author, and chair of ScienceDebate.org. His latest book is War on Science, The War on Science, Who's Waging It, Why It Matters, and What We Can Do About It. Another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk with Frank Browning, author, journalist, about his new book, which is essentially about gender and the future of gender. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Engineer is Howie Gelman. Engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our interns are Maxine Schoeffer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.